My first memory, actually, is I was a young teenager at the time. Lived in Eugene, Oregon, and a little outside the city limits, and there was a neighbor man who lived a few houses up the street. Man that I saw frequently, but never really talked to much. He's a rather quiet fella. He was not a churchgoer. His daughter was dying of tuberculosis. And he was walking up the street, and I bumped into him, and he started talking about what had happened. I had from him the first explanation I ever got of a chain reaction. Suddenly began to realize something of the very unique nature of this kind of destructive power, quite unlike any previous destructive power known to man. This man's name was Moore, and Mr. Moore, very sober kind of guy, he said at the end, he said, maybe this is what the good book is talking about. Implied this might be the end of civilization if we didn't use this power wisely. Well, a lot has happened in the last 38 years. I think it's the 38th anniversary, huh? 38? Collectively, we probably have the destructive power of more than a million atomic bombs like the one dropped on Hiroshima. Just a staggering, staggering reality. It almost literally blows the mind to think about it. What do we do with it? How do we handle a reality like that? Okay, let's just open it up. I frankly don't have a lot of wisdom to put on the table here. Maybe none of us do, but nothing else. We have feelings and questions, so we can share those too.
Seems like there's no erasing what has been done.
Sorry, forgot to do that.
Oh.
It's really the one thing I do well.
And in terms of being able to rid the world of nuclear weapons, it doesn't seem like a lot of hope for that. So I catch myself wondering where to go from here in terms of disarmament and what that means practically. I think idealistically it's pretty easy to think where you are ideally and what you would have in the world ideally. You know, pragmatically, to try to deal with the situation we find ourselves in today, and it just seems so complex and overwhelming.
Yeah, very big difference. One task is very simple, the other is very hard.
What I find really alarming, above and beyond the fact that the United States and the USSR have an overabundance of these weapons, is the fact that there are other countries which are beginning to develop these weapons as well. Countries which perhaps have a lot to gain through some sort of production of these is a use of a force to perhaps give their own desires or their own objectives more out into the opening, and that's really kind of frightening if we were to realize that perhaps nuclear war could be then triggered by some other country, and then the almost automatic retaliation from perhaps the U.S. to the Russians, thinking that they started the nuclear war, and nothing left for anybody.
Okay. jump right in if you've got something to say here, because it's a free-for-all. Yeah, I can't help but think myself, what would have happened had Hitler been the first one to harness that power? And when you look at the world today, there are plenty of candidates around, or occasional candidates around, for pretty insane use of a weapon like that.
Roger was getting us to talk about movies last night.
Yeah.
You all had the chance to see War Games. Mm-hmm. That brought out some really interesting things. I
didn't see it, so if you could, I don't know, how many saw War Games? All right, you better explain.
I don't know how good I am at summarizing or doing it.
Some of us still haven't bought our first television set, so.
A synopsis of it, maybe the ones of you who have seen it can help me out and fill in the gaps here. It's about a high school youth who is an expert at video games, and he has all this computer equipment and is just a computer whiz. And so he finds out how he can break into all these programs, and he breaks into the military defense program at NORAD in Colorado Springs. And what is the machine called?
Oh, goodness.
Joshua?
No, Joshua was the code word for the back way into it. That's not the name of the machine. They have a giant computer that has been programmed to play out all kinds of scenarios, war games.
It's called War... I can't think of this machine, but yeah, it simulates all these things between ourselves and the Soviet Union, and the strategies and the first strike possibilities, and he does all this stuff and does it as games. And so this kid keys into this thinking that it's just a new video game and starts playing this game. Well, he starts playing it, and so it starts turning on all these red lights in NORAD, and they think it's attack. But the very first opening scene in that movie is two men who control the buttons, in other words, to set off this nuclear holocaust. And it shows this happening to them, and the man that is supposed to push the button realizing what that means for the world, one just cannot do it. And so his partner then gives him the order to do that and holds the gun, preparing to fire it at him because he sees that as his duty for his country, to protect his country. And that's the opening scene, and I think one of the most powerful in the whole movie, because then the whole movie evolves around that and deals with the theme of how our humanity plays against the technology and how we deal humanly with the technology that we've developed, and whether that decision, such a decision like that for destruction, even though a president or somebody higher up makes it, the person that ultimately decides is the person that pushes the button.
Mm-hmm.
And the burden of that decision, then whether that should be automatic by a machine or not. And you all might want to finish and take it to the end of that, but it progresses on it. And
that's right. Yeah. It's
a new version of failsafe.
Mm-hmm.
With the computer in a much more dominant position this time. And the whole question of the inadequacy of people to cope with their own machinery. And it ends on a crazy note. Was it a game or was it for real?
Mm-hmm.
Was the machine in fact triggering a war, or was it just playing out a game?
Mm-hmm.
It leaves you hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very end, you think it's almost done. You get to this anti-climax, and then you find out Well, they found out how to control the machine finally and get it from playing this game. But then what happens is they really haven't, because the machine has taken control and so is going to go ahead and play out the game. So what that means then, everybody assumes, is the missiles are going to go off to Russia. And in the meantime, there's all this contact with Russia about, what are you doing? No, we really aren't doing that. It's just that our machines are out of order here. And it's real intense and raises some good issues.
Yeah. Pretty spooky.
Our kids have seen it, and they keep telling us we should see it. And one response that they've had is to see their friends see it, who have had no particular concern or awareness for the whole issue. And they quoted one of their friends and said, boy, if you aren't anti-nuclear before, you will be after you see the movie. And this is from their friend that couldn't care less.
Yeah.
So it must be doing some good.
I think it's another way of raising the question. If it only takes one mistake to be fatal to the life of the whole world, is there any way to imagine that we can go on indefinitely without somebody making one mistake? It's that kind of thing.
I'm going to say we live in Colorado Springs, and the parish is made up of a lot of people who work at NORAD and the mountain in the computers, and I've been in it. A tour of it, and it's a scary place. I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know what it looks like in the movie, but it's a feeling that you get in when you go into it, into the mountain, is a very strong consciousness of enemy. You're just very aware that we are in this battle against this enemy, and it's just totally focused on the enemy. And it's scary inside there.
What are the people of you say you have members of the congregation who work there?
Well,
or,
you mean about the movie, or?
No, in NORAD. What do they have to say?
Well, it's interesting, serving a parish in a military community like that, you start to learn there's a vocabulary that military people use that, the language, you have to get into it to understand it and to know that some words are have carried a lot of meaning behind them that we're not aware of. So I tease them a lot, they tease me, but if any organization that has the word peace in it, it's automatically suspect. But any organization that has the word freedom in it is
automatically
good. See, this is overstating it. I'm the only Democrat in the congregation. So if you notice the LCA or the prayers that come out of the LCA or the church, almost always we use every Sunday peace and justice. I don't know if you know that, but. You see, when you know military people, you know right away when they hear those words, they're thinking, uh-oh, look out. So we throw in freedom, you see. We pray for peace, justice, and freedom.
Yeah.
Which is okay, because I think the three have some kinds of relationship. But one thing we did a year ago this spring was went through Dan's book on Lutheran Looks at the Bomb. We spent about 8 weeks on Sunday morning with about a group of maybe 30 or 35 adults, many of whom were and are military people. And it's an interesting thing about military people who are part of congregations is that they tend to be the more open part of the military, and they're oftentimes more open and more accepting of ideas and things than some of the other members of the congregation who have no particular contact with the military. The more closed-minded people, I think, tend to be the people who stay on base and go to base chapel and have a much narrower experience while they're in the military. But the people that come to us have lived all over the world, have lived on the economy, which means they don't live on base, wherever they are. And so they've had a wealth of experience. Another thing I find is that in a public forum such as this, anybody that's active military has to be very careful as to what they say. And because they never know who is listening to them and who would be in a position in the future in their process of moving up the ladder to say at a certain point he said such and such, and that could ruin their career. But it's interesting that some of them, anyway, will talk to me in private on a one-to-one basis where they know that know it's in confidence, and they will tell me things that they will never say in public forum. And I had some of the people come to me during that class session we were doing, which they took me on the whole way through in a public way. But privately, some of them admitted to me that they had some very serious questions about our policy, especially the policy of piling up more and more weapons. One who's an Army officer now going to school in Leavenworth with Kansas, who said, he said that one point really got to him, that, you know, how many times do you need to kill everybody before you've got enough? And so he said that he was really going to have to deal with that whole question, and I haven't seen him now for a while because they moved. That's the kind of experience of having Colorado Springs. Interesting place.
Oh, that is.
I wanted to ask you a question. What was the name of that book?
A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb.
Where do you get it?
Here. Oh. It's published by Holden.
Oh.
And you say Dan did it? Who?
Yeah.
Dan who?
Dan Erlander.
Oh. You get it here. Does it have a study book with it, or is
no.
it a book?
No.
Check the resource center up by Shelley. Read.
Oh,
four.
The bookstore sells it too.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is Phil Erlander. So
he just happens to be my brother.
Yes. Okay, thanks for that, Phil. Who else would like to jump in here? Scott? What are you thinking?
Well, I'm just thinking, coming from a different perspective as far as younger, not myself, but people work with junior high, and I'm often shocked by the terms they come up with when we talk about the bomb. You mentioned your kids had seen the movie, and in dialoguing with some of the kids in my class, I teach 7th and 8th grade, we had seen Gandhi as a class, and the concept of that, some of them really varied. And then in talking about nuclear bombs with them, that they have so many more givens than even I do. I mean, I don't know if we're that far apart, and that they seem to all accept it. And Fargo, North Dakota isn't a big military place, and yet I still get a fear out of that. Now, you mentioned the first time, you know, you can think back of remembering it happened. Boy, I get kind of scared more and more as, you know, as these kids, when they grow up, will they understand it? And then they talk about mind blank. Lead of Russia right now is Andropov. You know, they talk about him being younger and not remembering some of the oppression, you know, back and forth. I wonder what's going to happen like 10, 20 years from now when our generals don't remember Hiroshima and Nicaragua. Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that's what I was just thinking about, was, you know, I wonder how different it'll be when we have a different mindset, when our leaders no longer remember.
You think we'll be here in 10 years?
Yeah. Otherwise, I don't think I'd teach junior high. Yeah, I think we'll be here.
But I think that is a question that the teenagers are asking, whether or not they will go to a dorm room.
I think it's tough for them to think about a lifetime career when they wonder whether there's a lifetime.
Yeah.
Sure.
I like the distinction. Now I'm mixing the Wounded Healer. I don't know how many of you have read that book, but he talks about a nuclear mindset and a pre-nuclear mindset. And a pre-nuclear mindset is a person that lived, you know, before World War II, before the realization of our power to destroy ourselves in that, in a nuclear sense. And a nuclear mindset is a person that lives with that reality, that consciousness. And he brings out some interesting points. I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if it's completely accurate down the line, but I seem to see that in people, and some people not seeing a future at all in terms of, will we be here in 10 years? A nuclear person would not live with that kind of future, where a pre-nuclear person does live with a future, a sense of a future. And you have those kind of two different types of people almost living in two different type of realities today. Another thing he pointed out, that it isn't necessarily a matter of age. So a junior high person could be a pre-nuclear person in the sense of not living with that reality of the future could be very short.
But you know, I wonder if we aren't afraid of the wrong thing. NEA, National Education Association, comes up with a lot about these studies people are doing about, you know, elementary, especially kids afraid of it. I wonder if you aren't afraid of the wrong thing, being afraid of the Holocaust. When you mentioned like the rulers, the Hitlers who can get the bomb, and they were mentioned the other day about down in South America. I have mind blanks a lot. Down by South Africa, at Nairobi, where you know, they tried to exterminate people. I wonder if that's where the bomb isn't going to be used first. It's not going to be the U.S. against Russia. I think it's going to be a small country against some dissonance, you know, or, you know, a desert area, maybe North Africa, Gaddafi or something, you know. You know, I wonder if when we start to just worry about the big and freeze up and can't handle it, if we aren't preparing ourselves for the wrong thing. And we need to prepare more for, you know, some of these other conflicts, the Iran and Iraq dealing, and worry about nuclear war there.
What would preparing for that mean? It's a good question that you raise.
Our mindset now is stop it all or we lose it all, and yet that leads so many people to defeatism. They just say, I can't do anything then. And I guess preparing ourselves for that would be get rid of that mindset and then learn to deal with conflict.
Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know, you know, what the mindset really is. And I know this is a fair thing to do, but, you know, you were asked the question before, you think we'll be here in 10 years. I'd like to, just for kicks, find out, you know, how many people here think we're going to be here in 10, 20 years? You know, my working assumption is, I mean, maybe just because you can't really deal with the reality, with the possibility that it's, you know, it could happen, you just sort of assume that it's not going to happen. And that may be part of the problem.
I think if I learned one thing during the war, and I was the Navy wife, so I was the gal in every port. And I learned at that time to live one day at a time. I think that was the beginning. And I think sometimes we bite off too much. We spend too much time worrying instead of living each day to the fullest. And then does it matter whether there is a tomorrow or not? Because if we live each day completely, then we are prepared for whatever tomorrow brings.
Well, I would like to make a distinction between, you know, how we personally handle the dangers and uncertainties of the future. I mean, to live that in faith and not worry, I think, is very much in keeping with the gospel. But distinguish that from a responsibility, it seems to me, that the Lord puts on us to care for His world and about the lives of people. we can't just say, well, let's only worry about tomorrow in that sense and not...
Right, you know, I see what you're saying.
Not take the responsibility.
But I do think we need to allay the worries of a lot of children because they are worrying about many things that will never happen. And I think as more parents and adults learn to handle each day, then the child will learn also to face each day without these worries. And some children are really facing some tremendous worries that they can do nothing about and that we can't find the answers to either.
Seems to me that there may be a lot of wrong worrying going on among particularly the young. Maybe some right worrying that's not happening among some of us oldies.
Maybe we need to get it clear in our minds so that we can pass it on to the children that we teach to. That's a real problem because I haven't come to... I was so relieved that the war was over. Because when you see your friend's husband's not coming back and you see you live in a community of wives who are waiting out the war is very close to families. Mm-hmm. And it was mixed emotions. Sure, it was a terrible shock. I can remember the shock that I felt when I realized what had happened in that bomb. But at the same time, I was thankful it was over and we could go back to living a normal life.
Yeah.
And you feel guilty because you are relieved at somebody else's expense. War is hell.
I don't know though whether we did go back to living a normal life after we did set off the bomb, because it isn't the same world anymore as it was before. We can destroy the world now. And we couldn't, before the bomb, we couldn't do that. We didn't have that reality.
I think most of us went back to our, picked up the pieces and
I think a lot of people
I think most of us
and
did.
Picked up their pieces, but it's still not the same.
I think that's how we see it now. Mm-hmm. I remember at the time, I was just a child, but I remember thinking, oh, well, we have this new weapon and it stopped the war. I was 8 years old, and at the time I thought, too, well, we're the only country that has them. We only probably got 3 or 4 of these things because we only used 2 of them, you see. And it was just a continuum from previous weapons. And I didn't think of any huge change taking place at that particular moment. But I think it's now that we've stockpiled them, built them so much bigger and more powerful that now we see what we've done. And it's, you know, beyond most of it's a sense of it's out of control. It's
We've locked out a lot of it in our minds, I'm sure. As I'm speaking personally, I mean, when the war was over, I didn't want to think about the war. And I don't think I did.
Just great sense of relief.
I think that's true about, you know, as a child in school when that bomb was dropped, I can remember, you know, pictures in Weekly Reader showing this mushroom cloud and telling of the destruction. But it was more than what a child at that age could really fathom. But immediately it seemed like that they went on in our educational process to tell us all the good things that atomic power was going to do for us in our country, and took us immediately away from the destruction to the good things that this newfound energy was going to do.
Sure. And as you've said, you know, it ended the war, and we had a sense of security because we were the only ones who had it.
I was a child at the same time, about, you know, 8, 7, I guess, when the bomb was dropped. But I remember, and evidently it wasn't immediately after that, but within a couple of years when we found that Russia had the bomb, I remember just living with dread, the fear. And this was evidently about the time that the Cold War was heating up or whatever. And just dread, just knowing, you know, I kept looking over the hills toward Portland, expecting to see the mushroom cloud. And yet I couldn't talk to anyone about this. I knew my folks would think I was silly for being afraid of this. But I just remember that dread and fear.
Yeah.
Right, we think of the 50s as being such a quiet, peaceful time, but I remember the 50s, one of the topics of conversation was in the early, in my freshman and sophomore year of college was what we would do if we were bombed. And we would talk about our relationship with our family or our friends, or it was a topic of conversation and a real sense of fear.
Building bomb shelters in our basements, yeah. Stocking them, being told how much to stock for how many people, and how to keep out an excess of people so that you didn't get more in there than you could maintain until the worst of the radioactivity was passed.
I was born in 1957, so it was a little after that time, but when I was a child, I remember the fallout shelters, and my family had built a fallout shelter, and well, that was for tornadoes, and it was also for this other stuff that I couldn't really understand or grasp, but yet I knew that that meant a time of war, but there was this idea, just in the very word shelter, that it was something you could get away from,
yeah.
And all you had to do was go underground, and that. So as a child, I lived with that reality of knowing, yes, that there was something out there that was awful, but also with the idea that it could be escaped, you could be protected from it. And then probably not. When I was a freshman in college, I remember doing an argumentative paper on nuclear power for assignment, and that was the first time it really dawned on me, I guess, of the potential destruction of nuclear power and how that could so easily be sabotaged, not in the sense that, you know, that we were taking safety precautions and how we use this, but I just realized how easily, no matter what precautions we could take, the possibility of that being sabotaged or that being undermined. And so from then on, I guess that really started my personal journey into dealing with mm-hmm. that on that kind of level.
Yeah. You had your hand up, Becky, you didn't?
No. Long past.
Long past, okay. Sorry, I didn't catch you sooner.
It might be that those of us that were in the war fighting at the time looked at it different too than people look back at it now.
Tell us.
I was over in the jungles being shot at it and had been hit a couple of months before that, but then got back into the fight again. And for people who were being shot at, not knowing when they might be hit, well, it's a lot different than to look back at it now. And like Jim said over here, I don't know that anybody really thought that there would be a lot more bombs made than what there were.
And again, that sense of relief, just having the Roman war over.
Right. But there were thousands or millions of people who were glad that it did so.
Yeah.
The what if business for me is always a problem. I can't convince myself that we should not have gone ahead and developed the bomb, because I'm convinced that, you know, there's all kinds of evidence that the Nazis were trying to, and that they developed the V-2 rocket and had a delivery system by mid-1944. I can't believe that we could have sanguinely sat back and said, let's hope the war is over before they get theirs made. Hard for me to convince myself that we had an option at that point. The option came at the point of whether to drop it on a city or drop it on a test somewhere with observers. And when Truman is asked that question, and the people who helped him decide, they answer by saying, if we could have been sure it would have gone off, we would have done that. But since we had not been able to test it in the atmosphere, we didn't know. Isn't that about what he says? Because the question was put afterward, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Couldn't you have accomplished the same thing with no loss of life by inviting an international team of observers and setting one off in a place where there was no life? And he said that we weren't sure enough it would go off.
It had been tested in New Mexico.
But not much in the atmosphere, mostly underground.
It was above ground, on a tower.
Yeah. But they weren't sure, and they only had how many?
Two.
They only had two. And their worry was that if they put together a big show and it didn't go off, then we were stuck with the invasion of Japan.
Well, you have to consider, though, what the entire military situation was at the time, too. You know, we were losing badly there for a while. And this was sort of a last resort for us, too.
I don't know. I think it's really interesting to look back and decide whether we should or shouldn't have. But I guess what concerns me now is what do we do now that we're living in the kind of world we're living in. And I don't think worrying or being anxious is particularly helpful. But I do think realizing what kind of a world we're living in is very important, that we are living with a potential disaster all the time, and that we need to be aware of that and need to find new ways of trying to not have it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I have never sat in a meeting where this was discussed before.
Really?
I go to a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
In our area, I've never, in our church or, you know, neighborhood or whatever, I've never heard this. We talk about the bomb, I don't mean that, but I need to have a regular meeting where this was discussed. I like what the man said over here about us not really being able to do anything about the big thing. Maybe we could do some small thing. Maybe that's where we should start, is a small thing. Maybe even having meetings to tell people.
And up here in the balcony?
Well, it's a little belated. I'm giving a presentation tomorrow morning on the atomic bomb decision. And at that time, we'll be able to respond in more detail to some of the observations that had been brought up about what options we had available to us prior to dropping the bomb. They were, just to give the brief outline, much more wide-ranging than simply a demonstration or the use of atomic weapons. For one thing, we could simply have waited to see if the Japanese would have surrendered when Russia entered the war. Russia had not been in the war against Japan, and Russia does enter on August 8th, right in between the two bomb droppings, and all of the British and Japanese scholars who worked on the problem have stipulated two things. One, that what really drove the Japanese cabinet to pursue surrender terms was Russian entry, even more than Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and two, that option could have been pursued because Stalin had said at Yalta that he was going to enter the war 3 months after the end of the war against Germany, which was May 8th. And for once, Stalin was true to his word. From May to August is 3 months. So that was another option. A third option was to have modified just slightly the Potsdam Declaration, which demanded unconditional surrender, because we knew at the time that if we had simply recognized the Japanese emperor, which we eventually did, that there was a good chance that Japan would have surrendered under those terms. And I don't want to go on and give a long, because I think it's more important to respond in terms of our feelings and memories. That's more useful than this. But I just want to suggest that really the range of our options were much larger than people realize, from the perspective of people at the time, not just from our positions of hindsight.
Okay, the question was raised here before, you know, in several ways actually by persons, what can we do? You want to talk about that? Do you want to kick that around a bit?
One thing that seems to have occurred in the last 2 years is that there was a heightened sense of awareness amongst, I'm thinking of the physicians, with the position for social responsibility, and you heard a great deal about that. And it seems like within the last year or so, you hear very little of anything. It seems like we've become desensitized to this sort of thing. And it seems like we hear a lot of, you know, the unrest in the European nations about this. And then all of a sudden, that seems to be not so much anymore either, and that's what is frightening to me. I think we we know we have these weapons and they're there and they're real, but it seems like we become sort of victims in terms of being desensitized. And mm-hmm. you say, well, you know, so what can we do? And I feel like there's yeah. such a sense of hopelessness.
I'd be interested to know if that impression you have that they're, you know, for the last year or so they haven't heard so much, and if that's really true. I don't have that impression. I'm thinking especially of the bishop's pastoral letter in the Catholic Church, which has gotten enormous attention, and I think is going to be an important factor.
I agree. I know the Archbishop in San Francisco was very outspoken about a year ago. But you know what is happening in San Francisco, where I'm from. I just don't hear that mm-hmm. degree of urgency anymore.
No, I don't know if it's at all reflective of the media as well, because I'm active in South Dakota with the Youth of Freeze campaign, and we were getting a lot of media coverage for a while there. And I don't think it's at all that we are lessening our activities as much as the media is not covering it as much as it was before. Now, I don't know if that would have any part in that, but for a while, you know, I'm the media representative, that's why I say this, because I was getting a lot of calls to do radio interviews and television interviews and things of that sort. And now we have to be much more aggressive in asking the media to come and do those types of things that would make it more in front of the public. And I don't sense that there are less people working on it. We are, in fact, I feel like there are even more, we are even being able to get a broader base, at least in South Dakota, which tends to be a relatively conservative state as a whole, of people from a wide spectrum working with us. But I think maybe I'm incorrect, but so much of our thermometer of what's going on is gauged with media. And that it's just a point.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering
yeah.
if that could be part of it.
Yeah, my hunch is that it is could be a very important part of it. Over here, old sweeper.
Here within the last year, the bishop of the Amarillo Diocese sent a pastoral letter out to his the members of the diocese, especially those who are working at Pantex, where the bombs are assembled, asking them to quit their jobs. And that is why we publicized.
Well, there's more to that. They've also put together a diocesan fund to help people yeah. relocate, haven't they? Yes,
yeah.
job training and relocation costs. It's not just kind of laying it out there and then letting people wallow. Mm-hmm. And there are about, 3,500 employees involved in that? Something like that.
Have any of them used that yet?
Yes. But in retaliation, United Way has cut off Roman Catholic Charities in the area.
Is that right?
And some of the media have cut them off. He's taken an awful lot of heat for
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Because the Catholic Church is very much in the minority at that time.
Yeah.
Hands over here.
I'm sorry.
Helen, you had your hand up?
I was going to say that I know in Ohio there's a nuclear freeze campaign, yeah. and it's I think I'm pretty high up on the priority list of the governor anyway, and his wife.
Bill, did you have your hand?
The original comment I had was just on that view. I think you're right, it is the media very much, you know, our media likes to concentrate on about two or three crises at one time, and, you know, old news just doesn't sell the newspapers and doesn't get the listeners, but then responding to that, whoever mentioned the relocation and stuff, I think there is some very positive sort of attitude changes coming around, and I don't know, when they first did, you know, instead of the splitting of the atom and everything, you know, everything has changed except the way people think. And I think there's starting to be a little more of a consciousness now of just a little more social responsibility that has come out of this nuclear freeze and the other just these other sorts of movements that have raised issues. And I know a good portion of the people that graduated with me who are now looking for jobs have told me that, you know, a lot of them are, the ones I know the best are a lot of computer science majors, and a lot of people who frankly are going to make, you know, if they're willing to go into weapons type areas, are going to make a lot of money. And a lot have said, we're not going to do that. I want to get a good job, I want to do this, but at the same time, I don't want to go work for Lockheed Missile Company, I don't want to work for Martin Marietta, you know, aerospace, they're going to, you know, I don't want to work for these places where, which quite frankly are the ones that are really hiring a lot of people right now. Mm-hmm. I think there are some changes being made.
Yeah.
Something that concerns me, I think, is it Phil? Well, earlier I have been in St. Louis the last 2 years, and it was very easy for me to get my thoughts together on the nuclear freeze issue. And then in October I moved to Bremerton, Washington, where you half the town is employed by the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard, and the other half is employed by Bangor Naval Submarine Base. And the difference of dealing with the nuclear issue in St. Louis and dealing with it in a place like Bremerton is just amazing in terms of the things you all of a sudden become aware of, and something that has really touched me very deeply, probably just in the last few months, is kind of the us-them mentality we're developing in all of this. And I don't know if that's due to a lack of dialogue, there's probably lots of reasons for it, but something that I've become more and more aware of every day is, even though I don't work at Puget Sound Naval Shipyard or I don't assemble nuclear bombs, I am just as much a part of that and in the same place as those people that do, and a kind of oneness with them, rather than, you know, we're working against these and we set these people up who are working for this, and just dealing with that tension between the two groups, it becomes very difficult, and something that I've noticed, and I don't know if this happens in Coral Springs too, but I've experienced a real hesitance to dialogue and to talk about that, but because of those fears and because of the juxtaposition of the right people against the wrong people, and that somebody's going to be right and somebody's going to be wrong in all of this, and if we talk about it, we'll find out who that is. I don't know, you might be able to share some more on that.
Been in the parish 9 years, and I remember when I first came there, after about a year or two, we started to do some once a month Sunday night discussions of topics that we needed more time on. We did one on baptism, we did, you know, the kind of the churchy things, and then we decided to do one on war, and it was just terrible what happened. We divided the group that was there into half and ended up in this just arguing against each other. And so we cut it off and quit, because there was just no way to resolve this thing. It was just getting further and further apart, and to me it was saying, hey, this issue is just gonna, if we let it go, it's just going to just cause all kinds of a horrible mess. And so then there came a period of time where we didn't talk about anything about this stuff at all, and then we did this 8 week thing with mom, and that seemed to work. I don't know what the difference was. Maybe it was just having been there that long and getting to know people. But it's a very, very difficult subject to talk about in a military community in the context of the church. But I don't know very many churches that do it anywhere. Except on, say, the larger church deals with the issue in terms of like convention. There you can do it, but a local church has a very different. But I don't know if maybe some of you have been involved in church discussions. You said you hadn't.
Why do you feel that there's a lot of problem with it in the congregation?
You mean why we don't deal with it?
Or I'm just curious, you know, if you could find why people don't want to talk about it, or if you could find ways that they could talk about it, maybe there could be some progress. Because I think you're right. I don't think we talk about it in the congregation. I don't know why.
Nobody knows probably.
Well,
I think one of the problems that I see in Bremerton is that, you know, people tend to identify with their work. And if you are saying something that they interpret as criticizing, you know, the nuclear industry, you are criticizing them personally. You are
saying they threatened them.
Yeah, it is. You know, and we all feel that way about our jobs. You know, somebody says, "Oh,
I feel threatened by the bomb," so I just don't know how to handle it.
I'm wondering something when you mentioned that about the conflict. You know, and it seems even now tonight in our group that we're discussing conflict, you know, the bomb or not the bomb. And going back to something she pointed out earlier, the idea of, you know, resolution. Have you ever noticed, I'm noticing more and more bumper stickers. I don't know if I'm kind of keying into it and getting scared of it. Get the U.S. out of the U.N.
Yeah.
And we talk about, you know, there's the people who don't want nuclear bombs, and they're going against that, and the people who want them, and yet doesn't seem to be there's a whole lot of push from the church to keep us in those kind of dialogues. You know, there's a lot of people working to, you know, we got to have the nuclear freeze and all that, stop Trident, and yet I don't hear a lot of positive coming out of the church of we need to work on becoming a, you know, with these other countries in the United Nations. You know, I think that's a beautiful body. And yet I never hear the church praising it or pushing it, and yet there is someone on the other side telling us to get out of it. You know, I wonder if that isn't because we are very conflict-orientated. Even now, did anyone else catch that in the discussion as we start talking about it? We start talking about the anti, instead of talking about, you know, what can we do good? Or what is happening now that is good? And the UN is happening now that is good.
There was a woman here for 3 weeks, and her name was Magali Rodriguez-Mossman, and she really got a lot of people thinking. And she talks about visualizing, and talking about visualizing as a real power. And one thing that was intriguing to me, and along with what you're talking about conflict, is that we often come up to talking about polarizations when we talk about this issue, us and them, whether it be in the United States between people who are anti and for or whatever, or the Russians and the United States, north, south, east, and west. But we were talking, and this particular conversation happened, a personal conversation about visualizing this as something almost as you would outside of ourselves as human creatures, that there is an evil that is wanting to permeate and cause the destruction of the planet. And if we envision that, the Nears, who are here as dramatists, they said, oh, wouldn't it be fun to, I don't know, fun would be the right word, to visualize this as almost a type of interplanetary type of force that was going to come down and destroy the planet. How quickly we would find that the tables would turn and we would see the Russians as our allies because we would be uniting against this common evil that was trying to destroy us. And we were discussing that wouldn't it be interesting to start to visualize the bomb as the symbol of destruction against all of us, not just the Russians or just the United States, but a common evil that is permeating our society to destroy all of us, and to visualize the positive result that could happen through the unity that would happen if we saw that as a common enemy of us all. And that was real exciting for me. I hadn't really thought of it that way. I mean, when I talk about it to people, I talk about it as a spiritual issue, but I never really thought about the actual, what you could say, incarnation of that evil in the bomb. And I just wanted to throw that out because that might be a different way of looking at it rather than conflict. There is a conflict there, but it's not against people, one another, but it's against this thing. So I just...
Okay, that's a good one. You know, our time is up. I hate to cut this off or prevent anybody from saying anything. Since I'm the moderator, I'll get the last word in. I'm intrigued by Phil's comments about the, you know, difficulty of having that initial conversation on war and then later pulling it off with a series of eight on the bomb, and others saying there hasn't been much discussion going on in the church. It seems to me that that is one of the roles that congregations and Christians can very effectively play without pretending to have all the answers. And maybe it's important to make that very clear and to say, you know, we're going to have differences of opinion, but let's agree in advance. We've got to respect one another and realize that we engage in this conversation as brothers and sisters who are concerned and groping. You know, unless we talk about it at the local level, at the congregational level, seems to me we're missing maybe the best single opportunity the church has to get involved.
Yeah,